From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
You have a wonderful, wonderful piece of Gaelic football history that some of us were lucky enough to be alive to witness and to cherish. Even though we're not from Kerry at all,
exactly.
We still love it.
Yes, you know? We still love it.
And I said, oh, tarnation, they're right, because on page one it said you're not covered. But if turn over the page and on page two it says you are covered.
I've just asked outside, but one of your other guests, are you in character or are you, is that the way you really talk? I was like, no, that's where I'm from, kind of thing.
Coming up on this reciprocal Thursday edition of Playback Daily, Mikko leaves the field. Marty Morrissey pays tribute to the late Mikko Dwyer. Schrodinger's policy, how one woman was both insured and not insured. And method or not, Peter Smith convinces as Philip Lynott. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's always said Phil Lynott and always apparently been wrong. Oliver Callan shook things up this morning, dispensing with the monologue and the music and going straight to his guest. What we got was over 40 minutes of, well, heartbreaking radio as Catherine Killily spoke about her son Dylan, who was killed in a hit and run. Last week, Cameron Cooper, the driver of the car that killed 21-year-old Dylan, was sentenced to 4 years and 3 months for causing Dylan's death. Following the sentencing, Catherine spoke about the urgent need for sentencing reform for careless driving causing death. This morning, Catherine told Oliver about her experience of the night Dylan died. And just a warning, as you might expect, this is an emotional listen.
Where are you when that call comes through?
I was in bed. I was in bed and it was around 12:40
right.
That early that morning. And
who's on the phone?
His friend, Jordan, who lives with us at the minute. We have Jordan now, 6 years. And he was Dylan's close friend from a very young age. Mm-hmm. And he rang the phone and he was absolutely distraught on the phone. I couldn't understand. He was like, Dylan, all I could say is, Dylan is dead, Dylan is dead, Dylan is dead. And I said, John, hang on, what, slow down, I said. Now, start again. What did you say about my Dylan, I said. And he said, Catherine, he said, Dylan is after being in a car crash, he's dead. And I screamed. I said, no, not my Dylan, you have it wrong. I said, that is not him, you have that wrong. And he just sobbed and sobbed and sobbed on the phone. So I rang his father, Paul, and I said, Paul, are you after hearing this? And he said, Catherine, I'm after getting a phone call, he said, but I'm after hearing he's gone to hospital. There was just so much confusion.
Yeah.
You know, we got no phone calls off any of the guards or anything.
It had just happened.
It just happened. And we got the phone call and I rang Dylan's dad and he was like, no, he's gone to hospital. I just did not know what to do. I was in a state of panic and I rang 999. I said, I'm at our hearing. I said, my son is after being in a car crash. Is there any information you can give me? And they said, you know, where did this car crash happen? I said, apparently outside the Red Cow. So they gave me the number of Glendalkin Garda Station to ring. I rang and they said, no, we have no information here about a car crash outside the Red Cow. So I just headed towards the Red Cow. My friend Rolf headed towards the Red Cow and, you know, there was plenty of phone calls made on the way to the Red Cow. I've never been to the Red Cow before in my life. Plenty of phone calls made on that journey there and there was a lot of confusion. No, he's grand, he's in hospital and it's this person and that, you know. And I prayed. Do you have it wrong? Do you have it wrong? He's in hospital. It's somebody else. It's somebody else that's after dying. And you just never expect that phone call. And as I drove, as I was getting driven there, I just seen the flashing lights and I said, stop the car, and the car was still going. And I jumped out of that car. I ran across the motorway, crossed the Lewis tracks and the barriers there, and I jumped over them barriers. How I did, I don't know. You just get this, I don't know what it is. Mm-hmm. And I jumped him. I fell straight on my back. I bruised and cut my back and my face. And I ran and I said, my son, Dylan, I said, I'm after getting a phone call to say my son is dead. Tell me it's not true. I said, tell me my son is not dead. You know, I was met by this big, tall guard. And he looked at me, said, there'd be somebody to speak to. And I pray, I put my two hands together and I said, I beg you, please tell me it's not my son. He's a good boy. I said, he's a good boy. He's only 21. I said, please tell me it's not him. And he just looked at me. He said, there'll be somebody to speak to you in a few minutes. And I knew by the look in his eyes that it was my son. I knew. And I shook from head to toe, head to toe. And I just kept saying, please, I just kept putting my hand in the prayer and putting it up into his face. And I'm sure that guard was like, you know, it was just, you know, I didn't know what was going on in his head, but I'm sure he just, that was the last thing he wanted me was as a mother pleading and begging into his face that it was not my son that was dead on that ground.
And you'd known at this stage that there's been a crash.
I've known at this stage.
Did you know it was a hit and run?
No.
No. The guard, he did his best and he
couldn't
wanted to stop
say
you
anything.
Getting there as well, didn't he? Today?
Yeah, I said, I just want to see my son. I just want to, he said, I can't let, I was actually past, you know, the red tape. I was at because I seen the lights and I was actually, okay. You know, I jumped out in front of the red tape and I was only feet away from my son and the guard came rushing up and said, I can't let you go any further. He said, there'll be somebody to speak to you very soon.
As things calm a little bit at the scene, do you have to identify Dylan there?
I didn't have to identify him. The guard came and she said, listen, there has been a road crash. It has been a hit and run. And we need you. You can identify your son if you like, she said. You don't have to, but I recommend you do because in most cases like this, parents are just in disbelief. You know, if they don't see it for themselves, they'll never believe it.
Yeah.
So I said, of course I'll identify my son. I said, he's my son. Of course I will. I said, well, what type of mother would I be? You know, it's like some mothers, you know, and nothing against them or anything. If they couldn't, they couldn't. But with me, there was no way I wasn't going to identify him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So she said, just give me a few minutes for forensics, have a board with forensics and we'll get a sort for yourself and Paul. And I said to Paul, I said, Paul, I'll go. I said, I'll go. You don't have to go. I said, I'll go. You know, save mm-hmm. him the pain. I'll take it all on board. I'm his mother. I'll take everything. So he said, no, I'll go with you, Catherine. He said, I'll go with you.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the guard came back and she said, we're ready now for you to identify your son. And as I said in my victim impact statement, it was like the road was miles long. You know, it was only feet away from us and there was a white tent around him. And I, you know, I'm holding Paul and I'm shaking my head. So please let it not be him. Please let him, they got it wrong. Please let not be my son, Dylan, not my boy. He's a good boy. That's all he has. He's a good, and he was a good boy. He was a great kid. And when we turned the tent, the white tent, and to see my son laying on the ground on his own, a white sheet up to his chest, and blood pouring from his head. We were only allowed to stand so many feet away from him because forensics were still there doing their job. And I said to the guard, I said, can I touch him? I said, can I hold his hand? I said, so the guard looked at forensics and forensics shook their head and said no. And I said, please. I said, just let me feel his face. Just let me touch his face. I said, please. And they said, can't, you know, just they're still doing their job. The forensics are still doing their job. So I had to take it the way it was given to me. So I said, right, you know, I want this person to be done. This person that killed my son, I want him to be done. So I left forensics there. I didn't play and beg anymore with them. I left them there to do their job.
That was the protocol. Your priority, obviously, were your other young kids at home.
Yes.
And you really wanted to make sure they found out from you and not from anywhere else.
Yeah, my friend was at home. As I said, it was very late at night. One of the twins was in bed. Stuart twin was awake because she heard me screaming. And my friend rang, she said, Catherine, she said, the kids are here. They're, you know, I said, take the phones off them. Take their two phones off, I said, because I did not know. You know, the way people are these days, they're quick to take their phones out and take videos of all this and pictures of all this before they even seek help for
it has happened.
Yeah. It has happened. Yeah. And I've heard of it, yeah. You know, and I've seen.
And your kids are 14, you want them.
My kids are 14 and I wanted to protect them. And I said, take their phones off them straight away and tell them I'd be home soon. She said, Catherine, they're asking, you know, obviously they've heard somebody have texted them or somebody. I said, get the phones off them now, I said,
right.
Until then I'd be home to explain everything to them soon.
Catherine Killilee talking to Oliver Callan this morning about the death of her son Dylan in a hit and run. That's an extract from Oliver's longer interview with Catherine, a brave, immensely dignified woman who's been left full of grief and anger by the terrible events of the night her son was taken from her. And it's well worth your time listening to it in its entirety on the RTE radio app. The GAA is mourning one of the greats. Today, former Kerry manager Mick O'Dwyer has died, and Claire Byrne was joined this morning by RTE's GAA correspondent Marty Morrissey to pay tribute to a legend of Gaelic football. First up, Claire played a short mixtape of Mick's best moments.
Well, I had many, many great moments, I suppose, but I suppose winning the first All-Ireland title with Kerry in 1959, that certainly was a great occasion for me, being the first man to achieve that from Waterford.
He kept it back to Mick O'Dwyer. Mick O'Dwyer is high.
I sat inside the dressing room, but we were going to win this All-Ireland today for one man, and that is Mick Dwyer! And I think it goes beyond any shadow of a doubt that he will go down in the folklore of football history.
It was a real good finish.
Listening to those clips, that would be a genuine tear in my eye because it brings me back to my childhood. This is why I and thousands of others loved Gaelic football, and I make no bones about it, loved Mick O'Dwyer. And I was privileged to get to know him. I mean, I was one of those young teenagers that my father brought me down to Killarney to be outside the wire to look at Kerry football training.
To get a glimpse of him.
To get a glimpse of him and Pat Spillane and Mikey Sheehy and Bomber. These were my heroes, and to get to know him. I got to know him because back in 1989, when I was trying to start my broadcasting career, Clare FM were covering the Munster Club football final between Castlehaven and Cork and Kilkee, St. Sennan's Kilkee. And so I said, I wonder would he ever do the commentary with me? So I got his number, and he hadn't a clue who I was, some lad from Clare ringing. And he was a legend. And he says, I will, of course. I will. What time do you want me in Killarney? And it started a friendship that I have always treasured. And he was a breath of fresh air. He was I think, before his time. He was a wonderful footballer in his own day. And as he mentioned in the clip that you used, in 1959, he was the first man from Waterford to win an All-Ireland medal. And he was both a corner forward and a wing back. But his passion, his love of Gaelic football, and his love of Kerry in particular, but particularly, I suppose, especially Gaelic football on a global scale, was nobody could challenge it.
Yeah,
he was special.
8 All-Ireland titles for Kerry as manager, 4 in a row. I mean, it's the record that most managers could really only dream of.
And in 1982, Seamus Darby got that iconic goal in the dying seconds to deprive Kerry of 5 in a row. So people thought, oh, well, that's the end of that Kerry team. And he comes back later to win 3 in a row. Like, this is truly remarkable. And as you mentioned, your own county.
Yes.
He went to Laois, and the joy that he brought to Laois, winning a Leinster title for the first time after 57 years.
It was incredible. And I was there in Croke Park. We had a couple of outings over that time. Yeah. And I don't know who, well, I think it was Des who said this morning that people, you know, people stood taller when Mick was on your side. And I think Laois stood very proud over that period. It was just a wonderful, it was great to be part of it as a spectator.
Absolutely. And look, even, you know, I've interviewed several Wicklow footballers over the years, and they talk about the glory days of when Mick was there and what he brought to the Garden County. He wouldn't be used to success, but yet he brought them to the last 12 in the All-Ireland Championship, which was remarkable. A Tommy Moore cup title, which is kind of the predecessor to the Tailteann Cup that we have now. So everywhere he went, Laois, Kildare, Wicklow, he spread his magic. He sprinkled a little bit of magic. He brought a smile to people's faces. He gave them a love of football. That it was, whether it was in Arklow or in Ockram or O'More Park, Port Laois or Croke Park, there was something about the game of Gaelic football. And there was always the prospect with Mico in charge that something would happen. And everywhere he went, something did happen.
There was greatness around the corner. What about his approach to training? Because it's described as unique, and he's thought of as the first modern style manager for Kerry. What can you tell us about that, Marty?
Well, it was a different time. And he obviously, you know, he also was in charge of the Kerry under 21s, the 1-3 All-Irelands, at the same time as being the Kerry senior manager. And he had brilliant players. When you think of Jack O'Shea, Mikey Sheehy, Ger Power, Pat Spillane, the late Paddy O'Shea, Tim Kennelly, John Egan. He had an abundance of talent, but it was his cajoling and shaping of them and brought them to a new level of fitness. He himself and Kevin Heffernan then I think responded with Dublin coming along and taking on the challenge of the Kerry team, and those great games were incredible. But I mean, I know in a clip that I used in Morning Ireland this morning, like he trained, I think, they trained 27 days in a row or some figure like that, which is remarkable in one way. And he boasts about the fact that nobody missed the training because they wanted to be part of it. They knew they were a unique team led by a unique man. And together, that cocktail of their footballing talent and his brains along the sideline and what he wanted them to achieve, you put the two together and you have a wonderful piece of Gaelic football history that some of us were lucky enough to be alive to witness and to cherish. Even though we're not from Kerry at all, exactly. We still love it.
Yes, we still love it. And look, listen, I mean, you talk about his brains, but really it's the passion, isn't it? It's the passion gets you over the line. Yeah.
And you know, when you get to know him, you'd have to say he was a most lovable rogue. I remember asking him to know what he was in charge of Kildare, would he do a clip with me for the news? And he says, oh, no problem, Marty, I'll drive up from Waterville. But what he didn't tell me was that he had training that night, so he was coming up anyway. So do you know what I mean? You'd have lovely little anecdotes. And it was that impish grin. He might have been in his 70s and 80s, obviously, in the last number of years, but that smile was still there when he was well and fit and was happy to talk football all the time. And, I went to see him a couple of months ago and we were still able to talk about football, and he still had that lovely welcome and that warm. To me, he was a very, very special man.
A heartfelt tribute there from RTE's Marty Morrissey to the footballing legend that was Mick O'Dwyer on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. We met Mary Ellen Hughes this afternoon, courtesy of Ray Darcy. Every month, Mary Ellen, who's a bit of a superfan of a certain crooner from County Donegal, reveals the new picture in the Wee Daniel calendar. And this is the reaction. Dear Lord. Well, Ray loves talking to the County Down native about her super fandom.
Millions of people watch you. You do it yourself and your mother in the kitchen. Open up the next month and you don't spoil it by going to it beforehand.
No, definitely not.
Yeah. Now, the last time you were on with us, we surprised you because we had your idol on the phone. Which was great, and you reacted as one would expect, which is great. Now, April 1st is a special day because not only are you revealing what Daniel is wearing in his April photograph, but it's also April Fool's Day.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you have to be aware and on your guard, don't you, Mary Ellen?
You do indeed. Yeah. Part of me thought I was being tricked, but luckily it wasn't.
Yeah, so what happened?
Well, I got contacted by Eimear McManus, that runs a golfing tournament. She's running the Legends Day down in Mount Juliet Estate, and Daniel is actually golfing with them in their competition. So she had asked, she wanted to gift us these tickets to the golf, and she asked if she could come up and gift us these tickets on the day that it coincided with the reveal. And she wanted to take her mother with her because her mummy was a really big fan of the TikToks. So I was like, absolutely, come on ahead. The door's open, the kettle will be on. You know, I was saying, whenever I realised it was the 1st of April, I was like, she's having me on, she's winding me up.
Yes.
But you know what? We were going to do it anyway. We were opening the calendar anyway.
Of course, it's the 1st of the month. Yeah, the reveal. Yeah. 1st of the month reveal, yes. Whether it's April or June or July, whatever. Go for it, go on. Yep.
So that it just so happened that, you know, she came through, God love her. And she arrived up with a few girls and her mother, and we were all biz to have these people in the house and with the good china cups out. Mummy had been making the soda bread for them. Great. And that was that. We thought this was great. We got the tickets. And then we were just, she said, you know, right, we'll do the reveal and I'll video it for my TikTok. And lo and behold, they had been hiding him outside. And honest to God, it was pure shock. I could not believe. And like, it was all down to her that she had done this, but we had no idea.
So there he was, Daniel O'Donnell.
Yeah, he was just, they had been hiding him in the back of the car. And then they had, one of the girls took him seemingly to the front of the house. And whenever he heard us screaming, then he came out, he came down the hall.
That's your cue. That's your cue, Daniel. When you, yeah. And he's heard you scream before. You know, he can recognize that scream.
He says I have a very squeaky voice. So he said, yeah. So I'm sure whenever he heard that, that was his cue to get into the kitchen then.
Yeah. Now, Mary Ellen, it was April Fool's Day. So did you did you touch him? Did you touch his hair to make sure he was real?
Oh, Jesus, yeah. You're right. I was holding his hand and everything. He couldn't get over my luck.
And what was the exchange? What did you say to him?
Do you know, I was just like, honestly, he is so down to earth. He is just, he's just like talking to an old friend. He was asking me all about my husband and what he does for a living, where he was working. So, you know, he's just such a lovely man. And we had a cup of tea and he had some of Mummy's soda bread. And I had an uncle call down to see him as well. That was a big fan. So he stayed, you know, for a while with us. And just the most lovely afternoon.
And did he give you any clues about next year's calendar?
No, he did not. No, I was thinking maybe I could get in one of the photos with him. But I'll have to talk to his team about that.
Yeah. And what's he wearing for April, as a matter of interest?
He's wearing this lovely sort of navy and white striped short sleeve T-shirt.
Has it got a collar?
No collar. It's a round neck.
Okay. Look at him. Yeah.
Very dapper.
Yeah. And he's in the T-shirt in April. That's
he is, yeah.
And that's risky enough, isn't it?
Risky for our weather,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it is. It is. Well, listen, that's it. What? Where do you go from here? How do you top that?
You don't. You're all downhill from here, and I read.
No, there is one more. There is one more thing. I'm not going to just be careful now, Ray. I'm saying to myself because I'm not going to offer you anything. But there is one more thing. You've never been to a Daniel O'Donnell concert.
No, but the last time he was with you, he said he was going to get us tickets. Yes. So he kindly has gave us tickets. We're waiting for coming up in May.
A very happy Daniel O'Donnell superfan, Mary Ellen Hughes, there talking to Ray Darcy this afternoon. There are 23 district courts around the country that deal with minor criminal and civil matters, such as drug possession and traffic offences. Today with Clare Byrne reporter Maura Fay spent the day at Trim District Court in County Meath on Wednesday, and this morning she dropped in to fill Clare in on some of the things that she saw and heard.
So a lot of the cases were just before the court for first mention to be allowed, things like legal aid assigned for disclosure of evidence, those kind of things. There were a couple of reoccurring issues. First off, there were a lot of bench warrants issued for people not turning up to court. I counted at least six cases where people didn't turn up that day and bench warrants were issued.
Okay, and in relation to those, there were some cases there where people were trying to resolve them, were they?
Yes, there was one case where a 26-year-old man was before the court on three outstanding bench warrants. Gardaí did object to bail, citing that the man had an extensive history of failing to turn up to court. In 2024, three bench warrants had been issued for the man, 10 in 2023, 4 in 2022, 1 in 21, and 5 in 2020. And he had been, quote, traditionally hard to locate. The man's barrister told the court that the man is now in a residential treatment at a facility in Tipperary for addiction to alcohol and benzodiazepines. The treatment facility had actually arranged for the man to come before the court that day and to get the outstanding bench warrants dealt with, and he was accompanied to court by a staff member from the facility. The barrister said the man is engaging well with treatment, and the Garda in the case agreed that the man was in better shape than he'd previously seen him. The judge opted to grant the man bail and fix court dates for when the man can either elect to indicate a plea on the various charges.
Okay, so an attempt to sort that one out. So what about drug offences then at the court?
Yes, there were a lot of people before the court on possession charges. In one case, a Garda told the court how he'd found a man in possession of €500 worth of cannabis. Now, that volume of cannabis might normally be considered an amount more akin to a volume associated with drug dealing than for personal use. However, the Garda told the court that he had checked the man's mobile phone at the time of the offence and found no evidence of drug dealing. The man in the case did have previous convictions. In this instance, the judge, McKiernan, opted to convict the man for possession, and he received a fine of €400.
Okay, moving on to other issues then. Were there many cases there now that involved violence or threats of violence?
There was an interesting case where only minimal details were heard because it was a first hearing. The man in the court appeared without legal representation. The judge asked the man, would he like a solicitor to represent him? And the man said he would like a solicitor to represent him, and he asked the judge to pick him a good one. Judge McKiernan replied that they're all good solicitors, and she asked one of them present before the courtroom to represent the man. Now, it was alleged that this in court that this man, while driving his van, had pulled up beside a local politician who was out walking and verbally abused the politician and threatened them with a claw hammer for not keeping promises made during election time. The case went forward to another hearing at a later date.
Now, there was a case there as well where a woman was allegedly assaulted in the presence of her son.
Yes, the court heard how a 33-year-old man entered the bedroom of the woman, headbutted her, broke her phone, her TV and also a window while her 14-year-old son was present in the home. The woman wasn't in court, but she did submit a victim impact statement. The man's solicitor asked that the man be considered for probation because of the situation with the man's mental health. The solicitor said, "I think he needs help more than he needs a prison sentence." The man was accompanied to court by his aunt. She told the judge that the man had been sectioned a couple of times, but the treatment had not been successful as he was still active with drugs. The man himself then addressed the court about his own circumstances and confirmed that he was still taking drugs. The judge replied to him that in all of that, you're only talking about yourself, and that he had viciously assaulted a woman. The man said in response that if the victim was in court, he would apologise to her. Now, the man had no previous convictions and was pleading guilty to the charges. In this instance, the man was given a 6-month sentence, suspended for two months, subject to the defendant entering into a probation bond for 12 months. The judge also directed that the defendant get urgent medical attention for his addiction and mental health issues.
You heard cases too, Maura, where Gardaí were assaulted.
Yes, there was one case where a woman who in 2020 had filled the lock of a Garda patrol car with super glue. She'd also thrown a folder and pushed a Garda. Now, the court wasn't given a reason for her motive in doing so, but it was told that she had paid the cost of having a new lock fitted on the patrol car. The judge in this case opted to convict and fine the woman a sum of €300. In another case, the court was told that a 30-year-old man, while in a drunken state, had threatened to break a Garda's jaw. The judge said that such threats to Gardaí were a very serious matter. The solicitor representing the man appealed for leniency, saying the man had 5 children, the youngest of whom was only a couple of months old. The court also heard that the man was currently not in work and had previous convictions for public order and theft. In this case, a 1-month sentence was imposed, but it was suspended for 12 months.
Okay, for 12 months. So what other kind of matters then did you hear at the court?
There are a lot of shoplifting cases, Claire. So one man who'd just been released from Lochan House, which is an open prison, was before the court for 2 shoplifting incidents. In the first incident, he stole 3 bottles of beer valued at €6 in total. And in the other incident, he stole goods valued at €20.35. The judge opted to hand down a 2-month sentence, suspended for 12 months. In another case, a woman stole €62 worth of argan oil shampoo from the Daybreak shop in Ashburn. The court heard that the woman had 6 children and was not working, and the property was not recovered. She was accompanied to court by her daughter, who acted as her translator, and she had €200 in court to pay as compensation. The judge opted not to convict and struck it out. However, in another case, there was a 54-year-old woman who was before the court for shoplifting items from the New Look clothing store in Ashburn. Evidence was given that the woman had 178 convictions for similar previous offences, and she had no money in court to offer by way of compensation. Judge McKiernan said, given the volume of previous offences, she'd no option but to impose a custodial sentence, and the woman was sentenced to 1 month in prison.
Okay, so that was the morning in court, and then in the afternoon, the court moved on to road traffic offences.
Yes, there were things like driving under the influence or speeding offences. I would say there were noticeably more cases before the court for drug driving than drink driving. In one case, the court heard how a man who had been in Ireland since 2017 and was working as a network engineer. At the time of his offence, he was in a relationship. The couple were attending an event had a disagreement and he took the car home. While he was driving, he was stopped by Gardaí and was found that he was driving under the influence of drugs. He had one previous conviction. The man was fined and disqualified for from driving for 4 years.
4 year ban. And there was also a case involving a row over land. This was between family members, Maura, was it?
Yes, the court heard that this was an ongoing issue over an acre of land, and one of the people involved in the dispute was before the court on a Section 2 assault charge. The court heard that last May, two men had rowed for 30 minutes, resulting in one of the men before the court smashing a CCTV camera with a rake, and also an assault which was described by the man's solicitor as a clash of heads between the defendant and the injured party. The court heard that the argument was about the positioning of CCTV cameras overlooking the land in dispute, and that Gardaí and Trim have had their hearts broken trying to deal with this dispute. The man was convicted and fined €250.
All right, so now you did speak to one person who was before the court on the day you were there.
I did. This was after court had finished, and I asked him what charges he had been up on.
Theft going back 5 years ago, and it's still not dealt with today.
Why is that?
Because the guards in the Avon don't have their cases right, and it's still dragging on. I could be in court 2 years later for this, and it's still not dealt with. But I don't even know about the charge, being honest with you. Yeah, I don't even know about the charge, and it's still not dealt with. Like, the guard hasn't turned up in court for the past, yeah. And the solicitor said to me he was going to get the case struck out today.
And tell me, have you been before the courts often?
Numerous of times, yeah. For drug offences and public orders.
And how do you feel about going before the courts?
Now that I'm a changed man, I feel like to be left alone and all.
Tell me how you're a changed man.
Because I was in treatment a few months ago, done my treatment.
And what were you in treatment for?
Alcohol.
And how bad was your alcohol problem?
I was dependent on alcohol, yeah.
And was that what led you to, I suppose, commit those thefts back about 5 years ago?
Yeah, most of them, yeah. Because I was dependent on alcohol. I was more showing off than anything, yeah.
Really?
I was sure I was only young at the time, you know. You have to be give a benefit that I was only young at the time.
How old are you now?
28 now.
And have you been in trouble with the guards since much?
Since I was 13 years of age. No, I'd like to close it.
So you want to draw a line under this then. Yeah. So since you've been out of treatment, where did you go for your treatment?
Limerick. I was in Brewery in Limerick for 5 months. And I'm home now doing fresh. I'm hoping to get into a barber course and get on with my life.
How do you feel about the victims of your crimes? Like, obviously you cause a lot of hurt to people and distress.
I do pity them and all, but like, my apologies goes out to them. But I'm a changed man, you know. You have to give benefit of the doubt.
And that was from Maura Fay's report from Trim District Court in County Meath on this morning's Today with Claire Byrne. On this afternoon's Liveline, Paula spoke to Jo Duffy about her costly automotive mistake and its consequences.
The mistake was that I had put electric charge in my car. Mm-hmm. So I then drove to the petrol station just to fill up because I was down to a quarter on petrol. Mm-hmm. And I came to the petrol pump on the wrong side, because it was busy, there were lots of cars.
Okay, yeah.
And so I took the hose, and I parked in quite near, and I put up the hose, and I said, I'll reach, you know. Now, I didn't realise when obviously I looked at the pump and it was black for diesel.
Okay.
Black colour. And then besides the black colour, there was blue. Mm-hmm. So I thought the blue was petrol. And I picked up the hose and I brought around the back of the car. It was a bit awkward. It came to
the angle.
The angle was awkward, and I thought that's why it wasn't fitting in. I didn't know that that diesel has a wider nozzle than petrol has. Well, I wouldn't have known that because I never put a diesel into my car, so I didn't know. But I thought that the non-fit was because of the angle I was at, which was a kind of an awkward angle. And I said, oh, it's sort of spitting a bit, maybe I should stop. And then I said, no, it's all going in, that's okay, it's going in. And I was putting it in when I looked over at the pump, and I don't know how from that side of the car I could see now diesel was written over the blue.
But you met resistance when you're trying to get the nozzle into the...
I didn't really because the angle wasn't a straight enough for me to actually try to put it fully in anyway. So I was at a bit of an awkward angle. I was going to abandon it, but I could see that in fact the fuel was going in. Okay. So without spilling out, there was a little bit of spitting.
How much did you put in?
I put in €12.80, and okay. I had a quarter tank in, so I put in about the same, maybe a tiny bit more. I went and paid, said it at the garage how annoyed I was, but sure, the guy has just taken the money. That's nothing to do with him. Yeah. And I said, well, I'm driving on electric because I had a full electric charge. I thought it might be okay to go. I didn't know. And I rang Kia. I said, sorry, it is a Kia car.
Okay.
And they said, you'd have about a mile, you could maximum. And I said, well, you know, I'm pretty much near to home at that, so I will drive it home. What I didn't realise was when you drive it into your parking of an apartment block, of course, the tow truck can't get in. So I thought that was going to be a big issue. But the reason why I wanted to start a campaign is...
No, but just take us position that journey home.
Sure.
You were under the impression that the journey home, because they say if you do put petrol into a diesel or diesel into a petrol, whatever you do, don't start the engine. Let the liquid get into the system. You did start the engine. You were under the belief you get a mile, is it?
Yeah. Yes, I did. I didn't know anything about you don't start the engine. I didn't know that at all. I know it now because when I was driving and Kia said, when you stop, don't start the engine. So I knew it, but it would.
Well, when did you realize you had a problem? Or was there? Did it show?
Oh no! I knew I had a problem because I put diesel in.
I know, did it affect the engine?
No. I didn't see any effect on the engine. Okay. And in fact, the AA guy said that because I was on electric, I should be okay because I was driving on electric.
Okay.
But I don't think that's the advice. You know what I mean?
No, I don't think it is.
Just make sure you
stop.
So
you're now in the basement of your apartment block.
The tow truck came and, I got onto my... When you get onto the insurance, they say, get onto your broker. I got onto the broker, they said I was covered. I got onto the insurance, they said I wasn't covered. I took out my insurance, I looked at it, and I said, oh, tarnation, they're right, because on page one it said you're not covered. But if turn over the page and on page two it says you are covered. So I got back to them and I said, I am covered. And they said, actually, you are. But of course, I will lose my no claims bonus. So the whole episode is, at least I lose 30% of it.
What was the rectifier? How was it fixed?
It's now fixed, but I haven't got it yet because it's up in the garage. €517 later. It would be dearer if you needed a filter. But apparently I don't need a filter because that's not applicable to my car, which is a plug-in hybrid, PHEV.
Okay.
But so many people said it happened to me, it nearly happened to me, and now the fuel gets dumped in the ground.
Yeah, well, that's what can you do? Well, I'm sure there's ways of collecting. Use fuel unless you're smuggling it up at the border, as you know, you read a lot about that.
But it must be so bad for the environment.
Oh, it is bad. Of course it's bad for the environment. So what did the AA do? Did he suck the diesel out?
No, the AA actually told me because one of my friends said, oh, that happened to me now quite some time ago.
Okay.
And the garage said, have a cup of tea there and we will have it ready for you in 20 minutes, which they did. But you can't do that anymore, according to this AA guy, because he said because of the theft of fuel from cars, car manufacturers made it that you cannot siphon out like that out of the car. Because so it has to go to the garage, it has to go up, be drained.
Yeah, but siphoning was a phenomenon when, Remember, there was a petrol shortage or a diesel shortage as well.
Yes.
And petrol prices went through the roof, pardon me.
Yes. And
fellas were going around or whoever, and they get a tube, and you drop the tube into the fuel tank. You start sucking it, literally sucking it, until you get a bit of suction. And the first first flow, you take a little mouthful of diesel first, and then you just just keep going into a canister or a container or whatever. And you say that the manufacturers reacted to that. I didn't think it was that big a phenomenon. But anyway, they reacted to it, so you can't suck diesel anymore, so to speak.
Apparently,
Okay. Now, you keep mentioning the tow truck. How did you get your car out of the basement then?
I said, how, did you start the car in alarm? Yeah. He said, you go over and open the gate. Stop worrying. I know what I'm doing. I think he just rolled it out, pushed it on a bit of a roll, and it actually was rolled out.
And apparently, I don't know how it is with a hybrid, but with an all-electric car, you should never tow it. You have to lift it onto the back of the truck because it will pulling an electric car apparently will destroy the car.
It has a little which I never noticed, a little circular in the front of the car. There's a little circular mark, but it's actually a hole, which is where they put the tow. To lift it.
Now, you're starting a campaign. What's the campaign?
Well, the campaign is that the petrol stations should clearly indicate this one is diesel and this one is petrol, possibly with larger print. Diesel or larger print, larger than the other print. One is not, they shouldn't be the same.
She's not wrong, you know. That's Paula talking to Joe Duffy about inadvertently putting diesel into her petrol-fueled car on this afternoon's Liveline. The NHS in the UK has set up a stop vaping clinic for young people to help stop the rise of vaping, and the person running the clinic, Professor Rachel Isbar, consultant in paediatric public health medicine at Alderhay Children's Hospital in Liverpool, spoke to Claire Byrne this morning about the initiative.
So your clinic deals with young, I mean, they're children, 11 to 15-year-olds, but you have, and your colleagues have encountered children as young as 7 or 8 who are vaping, is that right?
Yeah, that's true. So we are hearing stories. At the moment, it's anecdotes, particularly because of the way the data are collected. They tend to be with the older children. But yes, plenty of people reporting either that they're seeing young people, the very young people, vaping outside primary schools, or that they're coming across them in other bits of the health service. It's very concerning.
And the picture is not dissimilar here as well. And I'm sure anecdotally people will tell you that in Ireland we're seeing very young children vaping. But in terms of addiction, what levels of addiction are you seeing amongst these 11 to 15-year-olds?
Thanks. That's a really interesting but a slightly tricky question to answer. I think we've got quite a good idea now about the numbers of children and young people who are either trying vaping or vaping at least once a week. But I think what we're not so sure about at the moment is, of those children and young people that are vaping, how many of the are vaping things with nicotine in, and of those are vaping with nicotine, of those, how many of them have become dependent? So that's not data that's routinely collected at the moment, nationally, for example.
But they are telling you about how they use vapes, aren't they?
What
do they say?
So it's a very mixed picture. All children and young people are different, and they're all using them in different ways. So not just in my clinic, but just sort of the evidence more broadly, some might be vaping in a sort of snacking way. So they might use a little bit of a vape in a break at school. Some of them might be finding they have to leave lessons to go to vape, often in the toilets, because they can't get through a lesson. Or, they're very resourceful. They're finding other ways to either get out of class or sort of vape on the sly in class. And then obviously outside of school, we've all seen, children, young people walking the streets, and a lot of them might be vaping as well. So I think it's I think it's a very mixed picture with these children and young people, actually. And I think there's a lot of confusion if you're a young person about what's in a vape, what the point of having a vape might be, and particularly confusion around, you know, adults using vapes as a stop smoking aid, because we know that smoking is so catastrophically bad for human health that it's likely that vaping is not as bad and could be used as a smoking cessation aid. Mm-hmm. But obviously for children and young people, they shouldn't be vaping at all. They should only be breathing fresh air.
Yeah,
so I think it's quite complicated.
I see what you mean, though, because the message they may be getting at home is, well, vaping is a good thing because I'm not smoking cigarettes. So it might be just presented in a different way.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, there is evidence that vapes can be used in adults to help them cut down or stop smoking. And again, smoking remains a massive cause of premature death and illness in people that do smoke. I think it is complicated for the children and young people. And I think they perhaps, you know, might not be able to get their heads around that.
Mm-hmm.
And also it's worth noting that most of the children and young people who vape, they're not vaping to stop smoking. They've never smoked and they've just started vaping, if that makes sense.
Yeah, and we are waiting, aren't we, to find out what the impact on human health may be from vaping. But for adolescents and for children, using nicotine is not a good idea. Will you explain why?
Yes, absolutely. So you're absolutely right. We don't really know what the medium and long term effects of the process of vaping will be on children and young people. And there's a study that's being set up in London at the moment that will look at that over a period of 10 years. So I kind of say, ask again in 10 years and we'll have a better picture. But you're absolutely right. We do know, and there's a lot of evidence from smoking, that nicotine and adolescent brains is not a good combination. And so regardless of what's happening with the method that they are taking the nicotine into their body, the fact that they are taking in nicotine, we know that that is not good for their brain development and other things.
And of course, if you're dependent on it, you're going to have attention problems, because if you're thinking about where you're going to get the next fix and when, you're not focused on something like your schoolwork, for example.
Yes, and actually nicotine itself can have an impact on attention. So again, that sort of complicates things further. And what I will always say to children and young people that come to my clinic that are thinking of cutting down or stopping is that people might report, and there's research in this area, that they vape because it helps them with feelings of anxiety. And then you sort of get into a negative feedback loop that the nicotine might take the edge off that. And if you try to stop using the nicotine, you might experience withdrawal if you've become dependent, and that might also look like anxiety. So I think there's a lot of explaining how these young people's bodies work, how their brain works, as part of trying to explore their dependence and hopefully a desire to cut down or stop.
And how do these children end up at your door in your clinic? Are they referred by their GP, or how does it work?
So the clinic's been in existence since the beginning of January. And to start off, I just took referrals from my other colleagues, doctors and nurses and other health professionals in Alderhay Children's Hospital, who had seen a young person who had expressed an interest in having a conversation about cutting down or stopping vaping. However, I've now expanded that to accept referrals from GPs. Some other sources. So I've had a referral from a school nurse, for example, and I'm working with colleagues at Alderhay to see if I can develop a self-referral pathway for 14 to 15-year-olds. So alongside developing the clinic, I did a lot of engagement with young people about what they wanted, what the clinic should look like, how they would like to access it. And what came through very strongly is that they wanted to be able to refer themselves to this clinic. And so we do have a model at Alderhay for some of our mental health services where you can self-refer if you're 14 or 15. So my hope is that I would be able to harness that approach to enable the older teenagers to be able to refer themselves to come and see me.
That's Professor Rachel Isbor, consultant in paediatric public health medicine at Alderhay Children's Hospital in Liverpool, talking to Claire Byrne about her Stop Vaping Clinic for young people. back on the Ray D'Arcy Show, and Peter Smith is starring as Phil Lynott, or Philip Lynott, as he says the late Thin Lizzy frontman preferred to be called, in a new musical at Vicar Street in Dublin called Moonlight. Ray D'Arcy caught up with Peter this afternoon.
Listen, the theatre themselves have been very, very good to us. You know, they put on the three shows tonight, last night, and then next week, the 9th, all completely sold out. All your mob, the big noises, the press are coming in. They've taken all their seats, of course, the freebies, the champagne and all that. And then we'll be back in June, same venue, 20th, 21st, 22nd, and then we go down to Limerick. So, yeah, it's exciting. And we've got offers pretty much from all over the world to go everywhere, you know.
How long has this been in the pipeline for you, Peter?
For me, since I was about 19, 20. You know, I met...
What age are you now?
I'm 46.
Wow.
You know, so, I mean, I'm older than Philip Lynott ever was, which is tragic and sad in a lot of ways. But, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that, as an actor, you have to scratch that itch. And luckily, you know, in my case, black doesn't seem to crack. So I'm getting away with it. But no, it's an honour. It's an honour piece. And yeah, so far so good. People seem to be enjoying themselves.
And you have a lot in common with Philip.
Mm.
You've obviously gone over them in your head so many times, so list them out for us.
Well, I'm from Drimna, you know, which is Dublin 12. And we have our own, as you know, we have our own language, we have our own way of communication, and we have our own culture. Philip was very much at the forefront of that, alongside a myriad of others. So that, you know, kind of a lot of people, I've just asked outside, but one of your other guests is, are you in character or are you, is that the way you really talk? I was like, no, that's where I'm from, kind of thing. So yeah, and obviously my background, my family background, I do come from what would be, have been classically referred to as a broken home, broken family, a single parent family with challenges. And I was raised by my neighbours and my grandparents. And
Dad, what was your relationship with your dad?
Non-existent.
Right.
My father came into my life when for my first time on television, when I was knocking around with you boys, the Scratch Saturday days and all that stuff way back in the late 90s. And one of his friends kind of saw me on TV, and then there was kind of lots of communication, but he's in the United States. Between the jigs and the reels, it never actually worked for us to meet.
Right.
So there's a lot of there's a lot of similarities, shall we say?
And what was his story, your dad? He was in Ireland studying.
I was doing a master's degree.
Right.
Yeah, he met my mother. They had and I was the product of a very brief but passionate dalliance, as they say.
Yeah. And you met Philip's mother, Philomena.
I did. And she was wonderful. She was only interested, however, in talking to me for about 10 minutes, and she immediately wanted to talk to my mother. So she took my number and went out to the hall of her house and spent the next 2 hours on the phone to my mother, because she said she wanted to see if I was the real deal or if I was born with a silver spoon in my mouth,
right,
shall I say.
And you wanted her to okay you playing Philip?
Absolutely, because at the time I'd spoken, I think it was Neil Jordan's people, and Ollie Hennessy, who I was knocking around at the time doing a lot of music stuff, brought me out to Sutton to meet her, because it was very much, it's her book, the movie at the time was based on her book, and she needed to, yeah, you know, she needed to vet the people. And yeah, I think it was myself and Gary Dorden at the time were in the frame, Gary from CSI, and she was like, okay, it's got to be you. If I like your mammy.
So there was talks of two movies over the years.
Yeah, I met
Neil with, Jordan, you mentioned already.
That's right, and I met with
Jim Sheridan.
Jim, back in 2017. And that was the closest to happening. I know Jim had a script and everything. And I walked into the audition, I'll never forget it. I deliberately didn't sing, because you know yourself, Ray, we know each other. I've sang before, and I didn't want that to be the thing. I wanted them to cast me as an actor. So I walked in and I did recite a poem, Dublin, that Philip had written way back in 1970. He just put his arm in the air and he said, tell everybody else to go home and bring this gentleman to the next room. And then he said, is there any chance you could sing? I said, listen, I'll give it a bash, I'm not so sure. So I turned to Bruce Shields, who was in the room also, said, what do you know? He said, well, I can play Moonlight, Dance in the Moonlight. Do you know it? Or I'll give it a go. And a couple of verses in, he just turned around, he said, are you taking the, you know?
Yeah.
But anyway, he was happy, but it just didn't happen.
Peter Smith playing the title role in Moonlight, the Philip Lynott story, in Vicar Street, talking to Ray D'Arcy this afternoon. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, the HSE has warned that there was a suspected case of measles on the Dublin to Sligo train last Friday. Claire Byrne spoke about the implications of the warning with Assistant Professor of Virology at Trinity College Dublin, Kim Roberts.
Can you tell us what steps might be being taken right now to confirm whether this suspected case is indeed measles?
Yes, so I expect that that samples have been collected, so saliva, maybe blood samples have been collected, and that those are being tested in either a hospital lab or the National Virus Reference Lab to confirm the diagnosis. So I suspect this person has the symptoms. And we're just waiting for confirmation from testing.
And it is a very contagious disease, is it?
Yes, measles is one of the most contagious viruses that we know of. That means that it is very easily transmitted from person to person. And it's a virus that we transmit through the air. So when a person is infected with measles, they can be breathing out virus particles just as they're breathing, maybe also when they're coughing, sneezing, talking. Those viruses then hang in the air and can be breathed in by the people around them.
And if someone is showing the symptoms that you describe, what do they do? I mean, it's risky for them, isn't it, to go to the GP?
So if somebody knows that they've been on that particular carriage, so carriage D, on that train, and they start developing flu-like symptoms with a fever of 38 degrees C or over, coughs and sneezes, sore eyes is often a symptom as well, then the best thing to do is to contact the GP. And when you contact the GP, make sure you call ahead and let them know that you are concerned that you might have measles, so that the doctor can see you either outside or in an area that is away from other patients within the healthcare centre.
This could be dangerous in terms of complications for different age groups. Is that right?
So the people who are most at risk of a severe measles infection are young children. So children under 5 who haven't yet had both doses of the MMR vaccine. People who are pregnant are more at risk of severe infection. And people who are immunocompromised for whatever reason can potentially have more severe infection as well.
So measles, Kim, is very much in the news, isn't it? I mean, there are big problems in the United States with a very large outbreak.
Yes. So at the moment in the US, there's been almost 500 measles cases in the US up until this last week. Of those people, 14%, I think, have needed hospital care. And really tragically, 2 people have died. The problem with measles is it is a preventable disease. We have a really good, safe, effective vaccine, the MMR vaccine. But because it is so easily passed from person to person, we need to vaccinate 95% of people in order to protect those who are vulnerable, who can't get the vaccine yet because they're under 12 months old. They're little.
Kim Roberts, Assistant Professor of Virology at Trinity College, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about a suspected case of measles on the Dublin to Sligo train last Friday. And that's all I have for you on this New World Order Thursday edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shurathon. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app and the mothership. That's Playback, is on the air and in podcast land every Saturday when Sinead Mooney has a Catches Thieves Just Like Flies look back at an entire week in radio. For me though, until tomorrow, thank you for listening and good luck.